East Carolina Manuscript Collection, Oral History Interview, conducted January the 29th, 1977, with Lieutenant General William K. Jones, U.S. Marine Corps retired. This is reel number 2 of interview number 4 with General Jones.
I think that was much too broad a brush that the media painted with, and they would quote all of these people like Jane Fonda, and of course, as an aside, when people like Fonda and Ramsey Clark would go to Hanoi, you can imagine what effect that had on the for the propaganda for the enemy and the morale of our own people. But certainly there was corruption in the South Vietnamese government, just like there's been corruption. There's corruption in
Capitol Hill.
But it's the Oriental type. This is an Oriental people. They're used to doing that. You're not going to change them just because you say that's a no-no. Although I remember the commandant of the Vietnamese Marine Corps, General Khang, K-H-A-N-G, over his protest, Marshal Key put him in command of the 3rd Corps area. It's always been always Army, but put this Marine. And he told me personally, Khang did, that in the first month, he was offered bribes of up to $3 million total, and he locked them all up, locked all the people that tried to bribe him up. He never took a cent, and I believe him, because we used to talk to him about, he went to Marine Corps school, we talked to him about honor and integrity and stuff, and this little, thin little wiry man, he believed in it. He was a staunch man, a fine man. So they had their very fine people. I should tell you about an experience with him once that would fit into the time when I was in Vietnam, but you remind me, and I'll put it on the end of this just before we finish this session, if you want. In which I had General and Mrs. Khang and General and Mrs. Key for dinner in my villa.
What about Operation Golden Fleece? That's usually spoke of very closely with County Fair.
Well, I was not on that operation. I wasn't even in the country at the time, but it was a very successful Marine Corps operation, which involved a large number of Marines, a large number of Harbin troops, and employing these county fairs and sweeping of areas and trying to look to locate and trap and eliminate the local enemy regular forces, in which they did. That was a very successful operation, as I recall it. The area down around Da Nang in the two southern provinces, three really. There are 5 provinces in the I Corps, and the 3 provinces, which was short. South, that is, of Da Nang. Da Nang was just south of a mountain range. I couldn't tell you the name of the mountain, but it had a pass, a very narrow pass, and a tunnel that the little train went through, wound through, and the only way to go from from one province to the other right at that point. Now, south of that, and north of it, true, it was a coastal plain from the beach several miles inland, sometimes as many as maybe 10 miles inland before you start hitting the hills and the forest. So particularly in the three southern provinces, the terrain was very flat, very flat. And sometimes pretty difficult to maneuver on because of the rice paddies. But I can't really give you too much on that.
When we were talking one time previously, you said that you would comment on General Shoup when we got to Vietnam.
Well, General Shoup was very much against us getting involved in Vietnam when he was commandant and when he was the chief of staff, when he was on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he didn't believe we should do it. I believe there's considerable reservations on part of other members of the chiefs that if you're going in, go in and don't fiddle around with this thing.
But that was the basis of his.
Yeah.
Concern.
Well, his main basis of his concern that you don't want to get involved in a war on the mainland of China, of the Chinese mainland. You do not want to get in there. And it's a no-win proposition, and that you just simply should not get involved. And first we tried to bail the French out, and then when they got run out, we tried to work out a peace, which was done, and they was divided. And then when the North violated that, well, then we tried to support the government that had been put in there. So when he retired, he wrote a book about it, and he used some very harsh language that alienated a lot of his friends and a lot of people. I've always been fond of the old man, and I still am, and I see him every so often. Due to our World War II, we have a reunion on the 19th of November every year of the survivors of Tarawa that are still alive, and he shows up, and I see him then and a few other times. But that's about all I can tell you. I think that he probably basically was right, but of course the fact remains that our country said, you're going in. And so that's all of my comments have been based on the fact that I carry out my orders.
You have commented on General Wall and General Chapman. What about General McCutcheon?
Well, he was a splendid officer in every respect. And I think that had he lived, he might have been our first Marine aviator to be commandant. He was a man of about a year senior to me. He was an accomplished aviator, very small, wiry man, very sharp. And he was General Walt. He had command of the Marine Air Wing under General Walt, when General Walt had he had this wing that was reinforced, and then he had two divisions, the 1st and 3rd Division. And I've seen him many times when General Walt decided, for instance, one time that we had to abandon one of these special force camps and evacuate the special force troops and everyone, just pull out the villagers and everyone else, because there was an untenable spot that they had selected years before in a valley surrounded by hills, and the enemy was just moving in. They'd already cut off all the supplies. It was difficult to resupply them by air if the troops were not patrolling out from there. So it was very difficult, and I happened to be up there from Westmoreland's headquarters, and He asked my advice and asked all the generals, and I voted along with the rest of them. It was his decision to pull them out. And McCutcheon, I remember working out how he was going to get his helicopters to go in and get them out, and he got them out. It was comparatively few losses. That's just one example. Then he went back out as the commander of 3MAV. But while he was back in the States, at the same time I had, it was in the personnel department, he was the deputy chief of staff for air. We're very good friends. And he went out first as, he got his third star first as a CG-3MAV. And then I went out as CGF MEF-PAC and got my third star. So he was under me, although he was senior to me. But it was only for a very short time, and we worked together. I knew he was senior to me, and we were friends, and we worked along fine. Before he'd gone out, he'd been had a cancer operation, and they thought they'd gotten all of it. He did. He thought so, too. He ran a mile every day, every morning, and all this kind of stuff. But when he was out there, why, it started flaring up again, and he was brought back, and he was still doing all right, and the commandant made him, designated him to be the assistant commandant to relieve General Walt, who was retiring. And shortly after they pinned his fourth star, been the fourth star of him in the, when he was in the hospital, dying. So, had he lived, he would have been a very strong candidate. General Chapman told him that it, and he told me he'd send in four names for consideration. My name, General Davis' name, and I'm sure General McCutcheon would have been one of them, and General Chason.
One time, maybe in our first session, you mentioned something about a rice wine story that you wanted to tell me.
All right, let's hit those two, and then you can fit them into the right places. The rice wine story was concerned the time that I first went into Vietnam, when I was stationed at Headquarters Marine Corps as the legislative assistant to the commandant. And this was in or 64. I'd have to look it up. When I went out with him, the day after he made commandant, he went out to visit the Marines in Vietnam. Now, at that time, we simply had our helicopter squadrons in there. And we had, we hadn't landed our troops up to Da Nang yet. But we did have various Marine advisors, and it was getting more and more of us in there. So we went up to visit, during this visit to Vietnam, we went up to the I Corps area, and the I Corps commander arranged for us to go out and visit a Montagnard village. So we went to the village, and as we went through the main gate, we had a little 6 or 7 man honor guard. And of course, they're all just in line, loincloth and barefooted. And they were playing an assortment of instruments, reeds and banging on pans. And we went in the compound. And they had all the women, from the little bitty girls to the old grandmothers, lined up on one side of this sort of a parade ground in the center, of bare space in the center, and all the men on the other. And we walked up between these two ranks, and the chief was up there. And so he greeted the commandant and greeted the commandant's party. There were about five officers with him. And then the commandant presented him with his gifts, which was a great big bag of salt and some farming utensils, some axes. That's what they needed and wanted. So the chief then wanted to honor us, and we were told by this Vietnamese interpreter that he wanted each of us. There were five big jars, tall, thin jars, and they wanted one of us to stand in back of each one, and there was a hollow reed like a straw sticking out. And then these little Montagnard maiden, I couldn't tell you what age they were, got behind each one and held the straw towards us. And the commandant looked at him, and the interpreter told him, he says, "They want you to drink." Well, we looked in here, and what it was rice wine. And you could see it with pieces of rice floating on top, and these bubbles every so often, and it just looked horrible. And we just wondered what you had a pretty good idea of what would happen to you if you drank this stuff. And just unsanitary, because these were the Montagnard, very primitive people, and very filthy, dirty, you know. So the commandant gave us the command. He said, "Drink," I said, and so we all took it, and it didn't taste too bad. It had been some ice in it. It had been pretty good. But just as we did that, the little girl slapped a copper bracelet around our wrist. This was part of the ceremony. They all wear these, and if they give you one, well, it makes you an honorary member of their tribe and so forth. But down the line, one of the members was Major General Thayum named Bob Cushman. He was later one of the commandants. And I heard his voice, and he said, "My God, we've married him." And of course, that cracked all of us up. Well, that was the story about the rice wine. But the other story that's related to the time when I was living in the villa that we call Marine House in Vietnam, in Saigon. Since I was a good friend of General Kong's and used to go call on him as a commandant, now this is before he made the other deal, I asked him because I had this wonderful cook, this steward, Marine steward that went out with me. He's a friend of mine to this day. He comes up here and cooks meals for us sometimes. For a price now. Fine man. I asked General Kong, and we had all this linen, and we had nice service, and had a nice dining room, and what have you. I asked General Kong if I could honor he and his wife at dinner. And knowing that he was a very close friend to then the president, Key, General Mrs. Key. And he said, "Well, sure." He thought that'd be great. So he said, "I'll check with General Key." So he did. And he said he'd be delighted to come. So the time was set, so forth. Well, the first thing that happened early that afternoon when I got home, I took off early because I had them coming. They were coming around 7, say, so I got home about 6, and the Vietnamese MPs had already arrived, and they were stationed all over the roof of the house. They had patrols, roadblocks at each end of the block. And I was only about a block down from the ambassador's residence, who was Ambassador Lodge at that time. And so I could see that, well, naturally they can't let their president go out because he is a good target. So General Mrs. Key came, and General Mrs. Kong came, and we had a nice evening, and they got on, and they all like scotch and water, and you know, I'm like, President Key, he got a few, and he was taken off on the French. He was very mad at the French. He had a lot of reason to be mad at him, because, see, they all left overseers at these big plantations, and these plantations, when you flew over them, these big rubber plantations, looked like something like out of Gone with the Wind. They all had their mansion house, they all had their overseas house, they all had tennis courts, they had stables, they had a big circular drive up to these places, they had these had swimming pools, they all had their medical dispensaries fully stocked for their workers, and they were still running these plantations. And the way they were able to do that is because they were paying tribute to the enemy. And the enemy then would, the French would deposit in the French banks money to the enemy to allow them to run their plantations and keep their plantations. And then the enemy would take that money and buy war supplies to fight against the South Vietnam. And so President Key said, I'm going to throw all the Frenchmen. He speaks perfect English, and so did General Conn. He said, I'm going to throw all the Frenchmen out here. He said, I'm just not going to put up with this anymore. They're just stabbing us in the back, and they're letting the Viet Cong use their dispensaries to treat their wounded. And I said, well, I should make a dinner conversation. I said, well, President Key, I said, if I may, let me tell you about a very sad national mistake we made. And I told him about what we did with the Japanese Americans. And I said, now there must be some French that are third or fourth generation French here, that to them, Vietnam is their home. And I would wager that they're not taking part in any of this duplicity. And so he's sort of startled at first that here a brigadier would tell the president of a country how to run his country. But he said, well, you got a point there, General. And he says, I'll certainly give that some consideration. And I just bring that up to show it was a very pleasant evening. Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of evenings later, when General Westmoreland got in the field, he sent for me and he said, Bill, he says, the ambassador is really mad at you. And I said, why is that? He says, well, he says, not even I invite the president without requesting permission from the ambassador. And I said, I didn't know that. I said, I told him, General, well, it was, you know, I know General Conn, he knew I did, and we're friends, and he said, all right, have General and Mrs. Conn, but he said, I'm the head of the government. And I said, I just didn't think, I thought if he wanted to come. Well, he says, an ambassador really insists that I discipline you, and he says, so consider yourself disciplined. He said, now, what do you see today? And that's all Wesley said about the thing. But evidently, Lodge had his nose really out of joint. I wasn't all that impressed with Lodge, very frankly. I had a dinner when General Walt came back with his third star, and I invited him back, a lunch, not a dinner, lunch, and he was coming through Saigon. And I invited General Walt I wanted to have a luncheon in honor of General Walt, and I had my senior colonels, and General Walt, and had General Westmoreland, and some other Army generals, and I invited the ambassador, and he accepted. And I made another faux pas because Westy told me later about that. Walt was my guest of honor, so I put him on my right. And I put the ambassador on my left because he was the senior guy there. But the ambassador always sits on the right, so I didn't know that. But Lodge didn't make an issue of that, but I just table manners and things. So anyway, I thought that this story about having the President Key over and like a dummy. And I got to, of course, it hadn't been Boris Morland. Boy, the ambassador had to talk to me. I think the ambassador did say he wanted to talk to me, and Westmoreland said, "Well, I'll discipline him. Why don't you let me have it? You got a lot to do." And, but Westy just said, "Well, that's about, I'm about talked out. And I'm not too sure that I didn't see a couple of flakes." I hope not.